Imagine like buying a totally safe, reliable municipal bond, right? You're doing it specifically to avoid paying taxes.
Right, the whole point of a muni.
Exactly. So you hold it for 5 years, you feel amazing about your tax-free income, and then you sell it.
Sounds like a win.
Yeah, but then a year later, the IRS literally knocks on your door demanding a massive cut of your profit.
Oh man, the worst nightmare.
All because you didn't know the difference between a discount created by a city and a discount created by the secondary market.
It's such a brutal
Well,
trap.
tax rules around municipal bonds are just an absolute minefield. And today, we're going to learn exactly how to navigate them so you never, ever step on one.
We are going to make you an expert on this.
But before we jump into that, this deep dive is brought to you by Cert Fuel. They've got a full Series 7 course with like adaptive study quizzes, smart flashcards, and unlimited practice exams that are weighted exactly like the real thing. Check it out at certfuel.com.
Highly recommend it.
So, welcome back, everybody, to part two of our deep dive into the municipal securities chapter.
Glad to be back.
If you were with us for part one, you know we covered the basics of what munis actually are. Today, we're going much, much deeper.
We really are.
We're looking at how these things are built from the ground up, how they're sold, how they're taxed, and crucially, how they are regulated.
Yeah, building a municipal bond is it's a highly choreographed, incredibly complex process.
Right.
Our mission today is to help you master the entire life cycle of a municipal bond, the specific math that dictates its value in the market, and the regulatory traps that the Series 7 exam absolutely loves to spring on you.
They really do love their trap questions.
Oh, big time. So we're going to look at the history, the mechanics, and the real-world implications. We want you to not just recognize this information, but deeply understand why the rules exist in the first place.
So you can actually recall it under the intense pressure of the exam room, right? Not just guess.
Exactly. Understanding the why is your secret weapon.
And to make this stick, especially if you're like me and your brain just checks out during dry lectures, we are bringing back our recurring cast of characters to anchor all of our examples today.
Yes, our favorite fictional finance people.
First, we have Mayor Mike. He's our enthusiastic but, always budget-constrained issuer.
He represents the municipality that's just trying to get some infrastructure built.
Right. Then we have underwriter Ursula.
Ursula is the best.
She is highly organized. She takes on the massive financial risk, and she manages the underwriting syndicates. She's essentially the Wall Street pipeline bringing the bonds to the market.
Very high stakes job.
Definitely. Next up is investor Ivan. He's a wealthy, highly tax-sensitive retail buyer.
He's looking for yield, but mostly he just really hates paying taxes.
Like, avoids it at all costs. And finally, we have broker Bob.
Good old Bob.
Bob is a register rep at a local broker-dealer. He's well-meaning, he's super enthusiastic, but occasionally he gets a little sloppy with the compliance rules.
Which is going to be a problem for him today.
Oh, absolutely. So those four are going to be our guides today. Mayor Mike, underwriter Ursula, investor Ivan, and broker Bob.
We are going to follow a single bond issue from the moment Mayor Mike dreams it up all the way to the day Investor Ivan has to report it on his tax returns.
Perfect. So let's start at the very beginning. Before Mayor Mike can even think about issuing a bond for his city, we have to understand the regulatory sandbox that everyone is playing in.
The rules of the game.
Right. In the municipal world, that sandbox is built by the MSRB, the Municipal Securities Rulemaking Board. But there is a massive catch right out of the gate regarding what the MSRB can actually do,
Oh,
right?
yeah. This is one of the most fundamental concepts to lock in for the exam. The MSRB writes the rules, but they have absolutely no enforcement power.
Wait, none at all.
None. They cannot levy fines. They can't suspend a broker. They cannot throw anyone in jail.
So they're just making up rules and hoping people follow them?
Well, no, enforcement is handled entirely by FINRA and the SEC.
Okay, I've always loved the architect and the cop analogy for
It's
this.
a great one.
Yeah, so like the MSRB is the architect. They draw the blueprints for a safe financial system. They say, the stairs need to be this wide, the doors need to open this way, brokers must behave in this specific manner.
Right. But the architect doesn't arrest you if you violate the fire code.
Exactly. FINRA and the SEC are the cops. They patrol the building. And if you break the MSRB's rules, FINRA is the one putting you in handcuffs, figuratively speaking.
It's a really unique self-regulatory structure. And the reason it exists this way is mostly historical.
Really? How so?
Well, municipal bonds were originally exempt from a lot of the heavy-handed federal regulation that governed corporate stocks, largely because of the constitutional separation between the federal government and state governments.
Oh, like states' rights kind of stuff.
Exactly. The federal government didn't want to be seen as dictating how local states could raise money. But as the market grew, there were abuses.
Of course there were.
Yeah, so the industry created the MSRB to write specialized rules that respected the unique nature of municipal debt, while relying on existing bodies like FINRA to actually enforce them.
Okay, that makes sense. And one area where those rules are enforced ruthlessly is advertising. Let's talk about what dealers can and cannot say to the public.
A very heavily tested topic.
So the MSRB's municipal advertising rule mandates strict pre-use principal approval.
Yes.
This means a municipal securities principal. Basically, the compliance boss at the firm has to approve any advertisement in writing before it is ever published.
And this is where we really have to ask why. Why pre-use?
Yeah, why not just review it after it goes up?
Right, because in the corporate world, you sometimes see rules allowing post-use review of certain communications as long as it's done quickly. But in the municipal world, retracting a false statement after it hits the public does irreversible damage to retail trust.
You cannot unring the bell.
Precisely. You know, municipal bonds are generally pitched as safe, conservative, tax-advantaged investments. They attract retirees, pension funds, people looking for stability.
People who really can't afford to get scammed.
Exactly. If a retail investor buys a bond based on a misleading advertisement, claiming a higher yield or a better tax status than is actually true, the damage is done the moment the money changes hands.
So the MSRB forces the principal to review the ad before first used to act as a firewall against that deception.
That's it. Exactly.
Now, the exam is going to try to trick you here.
Oh, they love this trap.
They will give you a scenario where a broker publishes an ad and the principal reviews it like 2 hours later and approves it. They'll ask if this is a violation.
And the answer is always yes.
Yes, it must be before first use. Let's bring in Broker Bob to illustrate this. I actually have a direct question for you listening right now. I want you to think about this scenario.
You're ready to answer.
Let's say Bob is super excited about a new municipal 529 college savings plan his firm is offering. He goes on X, formerly Twitter, and posts a meme about how great the tax benefits are.
Classic Bob.
Right. He just posts it from his phone while waiting in line for a coffee. He didn't show it to his principal. What specific rule did Bob just violate? I'll give you a beat.
Think about the timeline.
Okay. He violated the pre-use principal approval rule.
But wait, it was just a meme. Does that count?
Yes, because the MSRB defines an advertisement incredibly broadly. It is not just a full-page spread in the Wall Street Journal.
No, it's not.
Social media posts, a tweet, a Facebook post, a text message blast sent to a list of clients, a generic form letter, they all count as advertisements if they are promoting the dealer's products or services to a wide audience.
That's right. Bob's meme is legally an advertisement.
Wow.
Now, if Bob sent a single personalized email to just investor Ivan answering a specific question about a 529 plan, that is correspondence, not an advertisement.
Okay, that's a good distinction. One-to-one is correspondence.
Right. But the moment it goes out to the public or a large group, the pre-use approval rule kicks in.
So Bob is in trouble.
Definitely. Furthermore, Bob's firm has to keep a meticulous record of that approval. The MSRB requires firms to maintain a separate file for all municipal advertisements for 4 years.
4 years.
Yep. Not mixed in with the corporate bond ads or the mutual fund ads, a dedicated municipal advertising file.
Okay, so Bob is in hot water with his principal. Now, let's look at how Bob interacts with the broader market, specifically how he quotes prices, because the MSRB has strict rules on this too, right?
Very strict.
When Bob is looking at his terminal and he puts a price out there into the market system indicating he wants to buy or sell a municipal bond, we have to differentiate between bona fide quotes and nominal quotes.
Right, so bona fide is a Latin term meaning in good faith.
Okay.
In the municipal securities market, if Broker Bob publishes a quote for a bond, let's say he posts a bid of 98, that quote must represent a bona fide bid.
Meaning he actually has to buy it.
Yes. It means he has a genuine intent to buy that specific bond at that stated price at that exact moment. It is a firm commitment.
So if another dealer sees Bob's quote of 98 and hits the bid, Bob is legally obligated to execute that trade.
He cannot back out and say, "Oh, I was just testing the waters."
But wait, the municipal market is notoriously illiquid, right? There are tens of thousands of different bonds out there, and some of them don't trade for months at a time.
That's very true.
What if Bob doesn't actually know the exact price? What if another broker calls him and says, "Hey, Bob, roughly where do you think Mayor Mike's 2030 bridge bonds are trading today?"
You might just want to throw a number out there as a guess.
Yeah, like I think they're trading around 98, but I'm not committing to that.
If he's providing a price just for informational purposes, to give a colleague a rough idea of the market, the MSRB requires him to clearly label it as a nominal quote.
Nominal.
Or sometimes it's called a subject quote, meaning it is subject to verification.
And here is the trap for Bob and for you taking the exam. An unlabeled quote is automatically assumed to be bona fide.
Always.
So if Bob forgets to label his guess as nominal, and he just sends a message saying bid 98 and another dealer hits it, Bob just bought a bond he didn't necessarily want because he forgot a label.
Yep. The market relies on the absolute integrity of quotes to function.
Wow. Bob needs to be careful. Okay. Moving beyond quotes, we have to discuss the overarching principle that governs every single interaction in this market.
The conduct of municipal securities activities.
Right. Commonly referred to as the fair dealing rule. This rule states simply that dealers must deal fairly with all persons and must not engage in any deceptive, dishonest, or unfair practices.
It sounds obvious, but it's crucial.
No, wait, hold on a second. I want to look closely at the wording there. All persons.
Okay.
I get why the rule protects investor Ivan. He's a retail investor. He doesn't have a Bloomberg terminal. He doesn't have a team of analysts.
Yeah.
He needs protection from predatory brokers.
For sure.
But what if underwriter Ursula is dealing directly with Mayor Mike to set up a new bond issue? Ursula is an institutional Wall Street professional. Mayor Mike is the chief executive of a city, backed by a city council and municipal lawyers. They're both pros.
Yeah.
So does the fair dealing rule apply with the same strictness to their relationship? Do they really need the MSRB holding their hands?
It's a great question. And the answer is a resounding yes. It protects everyone. And that explicitly includes the issuer.
Really? Even the mayor's office?
Yes. The MSRB recognized early on that while Mayor Mike might be a sophisticated politician, he might not be a sophisticated Wall Street financier. Municipal finance is incredibly arcane.
That's fair.
So underwriter Ursula has a strict fiduciary-like duty of fair dealing to Mayor Mike. She must disclose all material risks of the financing structure she is pitching.
Everything has to be on the table.
Everything. She must disclose all conflicts of interest. For example, if her firm is also acting as a financial advisor to the city while simultaneously trying to underwrite the bonds, that is a massive conflict that must be managed and disclosed.
Oh, because she's basically playing both sides.
Exactly. She cannot omit material facts just because Mike has a team of lawyers. The fair dealing rule is the bedrock of the entire MSRB regulatory framework.
Okay, so the sandbox is fully built. The architect has drawn the plans, the cops are watching, the rules of engagement are set. Now, let's actually bring a bond to life.
Let's do it.
Mayor Mike has the blueprints for his new city bridge, but he needs $50 million to pay the construction crews. He doesn't have $50 million sitting in the city treasury.
Most cities don't.
Right. So how does he get the money from Wall Street to Main Street? He needs underwriter Ursula?
He definitely does. And to get to Ursula, Mayor Mike essentially has to choose between two paths.
Yeah.
A competitive sale or a negotiated sale.
Okay. Competitive versus negotiated.
This distinction is heavily tested on the Series 7. The path he chooses fundamentally changes how the bond is priced and sold.
Let's break down the competitive sale first. How does this work mechanically?
So in a competitive sale, Mayor Mike doesn't hire a specific underwriter up front. Instead, he essentially holds an auction.
Like an eBay auction.
Kind of.
Yeah.
He and his team draft a document called a notice of sale. This is an official invitation to the financial world.
Okay.
He publishes this notice in the Daily Bond Buyer, which is the primary trade publication for the municipal market. The notice says, "I have $50 million in bonds. Here are the terms. Here's the maturity date. I am accepting sealed bids on Tuesday at noon."
And the goal is to get the best deal for the city.
Right. Whoever can sell these bonds and provide my city with the lowest interest cost wins the entire $50 million issue.
So various underwriting syndicates, maybe one led by Ursula's firm, another led by a massive global bank, and a third led by a regional broker dealer, all crunch the numbers behind closed doors.
Exactly. They try to figure out the lowest possible interest rate they can offer Mayor Mike while still leaving enough meat on the bone for them to make a profit when they resell the bonds to the public.
Then Tuesday at noon arrives, Mayor Mike opens the envelopes, and the lowest rate wins.
The lowest interest cost wins the deal.
This method is typically used for general obligation or go-go bonds.
Exactly. Because general obligation bonds are backed by the full faith and credit and the taxing power of the municipality, they're relatively standardized and easy to understand.
So it's safe.
Right. The competitive bidding process ensures that the taxpayers get the absolute best, lowest borrowing cost.
Mm.
In many states, the law actually requires go-go bonds to be sold competitively for exactly that reason, to prevent political cronyism.
To stop the mayor from just giving the deal to his buddy.
Exactly.
But what about the other path? If competitive bidding gets the taxpayers the lowest rate, why would Mayor Mike ever choose a negotiated sale?
Well, it depends on what he's building.
In a negotiated sale, he doesn't hold an auction. He just picks up the phone, calls underwriter Ursula directly and says, I want your firm to handle this. Let's work out a deal. That sounds like he's just handing Ursula a monopoly on his bridge project and hoping she gives him a fair rate. Why is that allowed?
It all comes down to complexity. Negotiated sales are used almost exclusively for revenue bonds.
Revenue bonds.
Right. Revenue bonds, unlike Google bonds, are not backed by taxes.
Yeah.
They are backed by the specific revenue generated by the project itself. In this case, the tolls collected on Mayor Mike's new bridge.
And toll revenue is much less certain than tax revenue. I mean, what if people just don't drive on the bridge?
Precisely. The credit analysis is vastly more complicated. The market might be super skeptical.
Right.
If Mayor Mike just put a complex, untested toll bridge revenue bond out for a competitive bid, underwriters might be too terrified to bid on it, or they might demand an astronomically high interest rate to compensate for the unknown risk.
So nobody would bid, or they'd bid way too high.
Exactly. By choosing a negotiated sale, Mayor Mike hires Ursula early in the process. Ursula's firm can spend months doing roadshows, pre-marketing the bonds to large institutional investors, explaining the traffic studies, and gauging exactly what interest rate the market will demand.
Oh, so she's basically testing the waters for him.
Yes. They negotiate the final interest rates and the terms together based on real-time market feedback.
So competitive is an auction, lowest bidder wins, used for the straightforward tax-backed go bonds. Negotiated is a partnership used for the complex project-backed revenue bonds.
Got it.
It's a key distinction.
Now, I want to jump back to the competitive sale for a second, because there is a highly testable math concept hidden there.
Oh, definitely.
When Mayor Mike opens those sealed envelopes, how does he actually calculate which syndicate offered the lowest interest cost? The study materials mention two different methods, NI versus TIC, net interest cost versus true interest cost.
This is a classic exam topic. You'll definitely see it.
So what's the difference? Net interest cost, or NIC, is the older, simpler method. It is essentially a straight line average.
Okay, simple math.
Right. It just looks at the total amount of interest dollars the city will pay over the entire life of the bond, subtracts any premium the underwriter offered, and divides it by the bond years. It's just simple arithmetic.
But simple isn't always accurate in finance.
Exactly. The problem with NIC is that it completely ignores when those interest payments are made. And this brings us to TIC. True interest cost.
TIC
is a much more advanced calculation that accounts for the time value of money.
The time value of money. This is a foundational concept. What does this actually mean in plain English, and why does Mayor Mike care?
It means that a dollar paid by the city in year one is a heavier economic burden than a dollar paid in year 20.
Because of inflation.
Inflation and lost opportunity cost. If the city has to pay out $1 million today, that's $1 million they can't invest, and it's $1 million valued in today's purchasing power.
Right. $1 million today buys more than $1 million in 20 years.
Exactly. If they pay that same $1 million 20 years from now, inflation will have eroded its value. It will hurt less to pay it.
That makes total sense.
So TIER uses complex present value discounting formulas to weigh the early payments more heavily than the later payments.
So if an underwriter was trying to, like, game the NIC system, they might structure their bid so they demand massive interest payments in the first 5 years and tiny interest payments in the last 15 years.
Exactly right.
Under the simple NIC math, the average might look low, so they win the bid. But Mayor Mike would be getting crushed having to pay all that cash up front.
Yes. TIER prevents that manipulation because it penalizes front-loaded interest payments.
So TIER is the superior method.
It is. TIER discounts all future cash flows back to their present value. So if the exam gives you a question asking which method is more accurate, which method prevents structural manipulation, or which method consider the time value of money, the answer is always, invariably, true interest cost, or TIER.
Lock that in. TS equals time value of money. All right, so let's say Ursula submits the winning TX bid and wins the right to underwrite Mayor Mike's $50 million bridge bonds.
She won the auction.
She is now on the hook to give the city $50 million. But that is a massive amount of capital risk for just Ursula's firm.
Massive.
If interest rates suddenly spike the next day and she can't sell these bonds to the public at the price she planned, her firm will take a catastrophic loss. She is not going to take that risk alone.
No underwriter would. She forms a syndicate.
A syndicate? Explain that.
A syndicate is a temporary joint venture of broker-dealers who band together to share the financial risk of underwriting a new issue.
So she brings in backup.
Right. Ursula's firm will act as the lead manager, but she might bring in 10 other firms to help her sell the $50 million issue.
Mm-hmm.
To formalize this, they all sign a legal contract called a syndicate letter, or an agreement among underwriters.
And this document is critical because it establishes exactly how the risk and the rewards are shared among those 11 firms.
Yes, very critical.
Specifically, it dictates whether they are operating an Eastern account or a Western account. And this is a concept that trips up so many people, but there is a brilliant way to visualize it.
The restaurant analogy. I love this one.
Yeah, we're talking about Eastern, which means undivided accounts, versus Western, which means divided accounts. Let's walk through the analogy.
Let's hear it.
Okay. An Eastern account is like going to a very expensive restaurant with 10 of your friends and agreeing up front to split the bill evenly.
That's always dangerous.
Oh, completely. It is an undivided obligation. Let's say broker Bob is at this dinner. Bob is trying to save money. He orders a small side salad and a glass of tap water.
Okay, cheap date.
But underwriter Ursula orders 3 lobsters, a filet mignon, and 2 bottles of vintage champagne. When the massive bill comes, they divide it by 11.
Poor Bob.
Exactly. Bob is legally obligated to pay a percentage of Ursula's lobsters, even though he only ate a salad. He has shared liability for the entire table.
That is a painfully accurate visualization of an Eastern syndicate.
It's the worst kind of dinner party.
So let's translate it to bond terms. Let's say the syndicate is trying to sell $50 million in bonds, and Bob's firm agreed to a 10% participation rate.
Okay, 10%.
That means Bob's firm is responsible for selling $5 million worth of bonds. Now, let's say Bob is an incredible salesman. He sells his $5 million allocation on the very first morning. He thinks he's done.
He's ready to go home.
Right. But Ursula's firm and a few others fail miserably. At the end of the week, there are still $10 million worth of bonds sitting unsold in the syndicate's inventory.
In an Eastern account, is Bob off the hook?
Absolutely not. Because the account is undivided, the remaining $10 million in unsold bonds is a shared liability.
Oh, wow.
Bob's firm still has a 10% liability. So Bob's firm is forced to absorb 10% of that $10 million, which is $1 million worth of unsold bonds, into their own inventory, even though Bob already sold his original share.
That's crazy.
In an Eastern account, you are never off the hook until the entire undivided issue is completely sold.
Now, contrast that with a Western account. Western is separate checks. It is divided. You sit down at the restaurant and you tell the waiter immediately, put my salad and water on my own card and let Ursula figure out how to pay for her own lobsters.
Much safer.
You only pay for exactly what you ordered.
Yes. In a Western syndicate, the liability is strictly divided. If Bob's firm agrees to take $5 million of the $50 million issue and Bob successfully sells his $5 million, his firm's liability drops to zero.
He's entirely done.
He's entirely done. Even if the rest of the syndicate is drowning in $45 million of unsold bonds, Bob's firm has no further obligation. They take their profit and go home.
So this leads to a very logical question that the exam loves to ask. Which account type carries significantly more risk for the individual high-performing syndicate member?
It is the Eastern account.
Because of that lingering liability.
Right. Because of that lingering shared liability. A firm could do everything right, sell their entire allocation, and still end up taking a loss because the other members failed.
The exam will try to get you to confuse these two constantly. Eastern is undivided, shared liability, higher risk. Western is divided, individual liability, lower risk.
And as a point of reality, the vast majority of municipal syndicates are formed as Eastern accounts.
Wait, really? Why would anyone agree to that?
Because the lead manager, Ursula, wants everyone highly incentivized to help sell every single bond.
Oh, I see.
If it were Western, Bob would sell his chunk and then go play golf while Ursula struggled. In an Eastern account, Bob has to stay on the phones helping Ursula sell the rest because otherwise he's going to end up eating her unsold inventory.
Exactly. It aligns the incentives of the entire group. They're all in the same boat.
Precisely. Now, let's follow the money. Ursula and her syndicate successfully sell the $50 million in bonds to the public. How do these broker-dealers actually get paid? They don't work for free.
Definitely not. This introduces the concept of the underwriting spread.
The spread is the lifeblood of Wall Street.
It's simply the difference between the wholesale price the syndicate pays Mayor Mike for the bonds and the retail price they sell them for to the public, like investor Ivan.
Let's do the math on that.
Okay, let's say they buy the bonds from the city at $990 each and sell them to the public at par, which is $1,000. That is a $10 spread per bond.
That $10 is the total profit pool.
But it doesn't just go into one big pot. It is chopped up into very specific pieces, and the exam will test you on exactly who gets what.
Let's dissect that $10 spread. It is typically broken into three components. The first component is the management fee.
Let's say that is $1 out of the $10. Who gets this?
That $1 goes exclusively to Ursula's firm. She is the lead manager. She did the heavy lifting of negotiating with the city, structuring the bond, and forming the syndicate.
So she gets paid for her brain power.
Right. She gets a fee off the top for her organizational expertise. It is usually the smallest piece of the spread.
Okay, so there's $9 left. The second piece is the additional takedown.
Let's allocate $2 to the additional takedown. This money goes to the syndicate members as compensation simply for being part of the syndicate and taking on the financial risk of the underwriting.
So just for showing up and risking their capital.
Exactly. Even if a member doesn't personally sell a specific bond, if they committed capital to the syndicate, they earn the additional takedown on the bonds that are sold.
So we have $1 for the manager, $2 for the syndicate risk takers. That leaves $7. The third and biggest piece is the selling concession.
The selling concession is the reward for the boots on the ground.
It goes to whoever actually picks up the phone, finds investor Ivan, pitches him the bond, and closes the sale.
It is the largest piece of the spread because distributing the bonds to retail investors is the hardest and most vital part of the process.
It's the actual sales commission.
Right. If broker Bob at a small regional firm finds the buyer, his firm earns that $7 selling concession.
So we have the management fee at $1, the additional takedown at $2, and the selling concession at $7. Now, pay very close attention here. Stop whatever you're doing right now. If you're walking your dog, literally tell your dog this formula.
Yes, listen up.
Because there is a formula that catches almost everyone off guard on test day. We need to talk about the total takedown. Mm-hmm. Intuition tells you that the word total means you should add up all the fees.
But you don't.
The formula for total takedown strictly excludes the management fee. I will repeat that. Total takedown equals the additional takedown plus the selling concession. It does not include the manager's cut.
It is a classic trick question. They will give you a scenario. A bond has a $1 management fee, a $2 additional takedown, and a $7 selling concession. What is the total takedown?
The instinct is to say $10.
But the correct answer is $9.
Mm.
The reasoning is that the total takedown represents the total compensation available to the syndicate members who are actually selling the bonds, separate from the fee paid to the lead manager for organizing the deal.
It is vital to separate the manager's cut from the syndicate's sales cut.
Absolutely vital.
Lock that formula in. Total takedown equals additional takedown plus selling concession. Okay, now let's talk about the logistics of the sale. Let's say Mayor Mike's bridge bonds are incredibly popular.
They're flying off the shelf.
They offer a great yield, the city has a high credit rating, and the market is starved for good municipal paper. Ursula has $50 million in bonds to sell, but she receives $100 million in orders from various brokers.
It's heavily oversubscribed.
The issue is heavily oversubscribed. How does she decide who gets the bonds and who gets left empty-handed? She can't just play favorites, right?
No, she cannot play favorites because of the MSRB's fair dealing rules.
There's that rule again.
Yep. To ensure fairness and transparency, the MSRB requires the syndicate manager to establish a strict priority of orders before the first offer is even made. The manager must follow this priority strictly when allocating the bonds.
And what's the priority?
The standard priority is universally memorized using the acronym PGDM.
PGDM? I remember it as please get dessert made, or to use the actual terms, pre-sale, group, designated, member.
Let's walk through a simulated order book to understand exactly why these orders are ranked in this specific hierarchy. It is all about risk and reward for the syndicate as a whole.
Okay, let's start at the top. Priority one goes to pre-sale orders. What are those?
These are orders that were placed by investors before the syndicate even won the competitive bid from Mayor Mike.
So investor Ivan calls Ursula on Monday and says, if you win the bid tomorrow, I commit to buying $1 million of these bonds. Why does Ivan get top priority?
Because Ivan committed his capital when the syndicate was facing the maximum amount of uncertainty.
He took a leap of faith.
He did. Having pre-sale orders in hand allows Ursula to bid more aggressively because she knows she already has guaranteed buyers for a portion of the issue.
That makes sense.
Because pre-sale orders reduce the risk for the entire syndicate before the deal is even finalized, they are rewarded with the absolute highest priority.
Okay, priority two, group net orders. What are these?
Group net orders are orders placed after the bid is won. But the profit from these orders is placed into the group pot and shared among all the syndicate members according to their participation percentage.
Going back to our restaurant analogy, it's like someone buying an appetizer for the whole table.
Perfect analogy. Because a group net order financially benefits every single member of the syndicate, it is given the second highest priority. The entire team wins.
Got it. Priority three, designated orders. This is a bit more specific.
A designated order is usually placed by a large institutional buyer, like a mutual fund. The institution places a massive order, but they specify or designate that the selling concession profit should go to two or three specific firms within the syndicate that they have good relationships with.
So the profit doesn't go to the whole group, it only goes to a few selected members.
Right, because it benefits fewer people than a group order, it drops down to priority three.
And finally, priority four, sitting at the bottom of the barrel, member orders.
A member order, or a related portfolio order, is when a single syndicate member places an order for its own firm's inventory, or for a specific retail customer of their own firm.
For example, broker Bob places an order just for his client, investor Ivan.
Exactly. The entire profit from that sale goes exclusively to Bob's firm. Nobody else in the syndicate benefits.
Because it is essentially a selfish order that only enriches one member, the syndicate rules place it last in line.
If the issue is oversubscribed by pre-sale and group orders, the member orders get completely wiped out and receive zero bonds.
Please get dessert made. Pre-sale, group, designated, member. Notice the pattern. The priority moves from orders that benefit the entire syndicate the most down to orders that only benefit a single member.
It's an elegant system to manage the inherent conflicts of interest within a team of fiercely competitive broker-dealers.
It really is. So Ursula has successfully allocated and sold the $50 million worth of bridge bonds. The money is raised, the construction crews are breaking ground. But in a heavily regulated financial market, a handshake and a phone call don't cut it. Investor Ivan just wired a massive amount of cash to buy his allocation. How does he legally verify what he just bought?
He needs paperwork.
Right. What are the risks? What are the city's financials? That brings us to the disclosure requirements.
In the corporate world, if a company like Apple issues new stock, they have to file a massive prospectus with the Securities and Exchange Commission, the SEC.
But the municipal market is fundamentally different. Municipal securities are entirely exempt from SEC registration.
This is a huge point.
Let's pause on that because it is a massive exam trap. Why are municipal bonds exempt? It goes back to federalism, right? The Tower Amendment.
Exactly. The Tower Amendment to the Securities Exchange Act specifically prohibits the SEC or the MSRB from requiring municipal issuers like Mayor Mike City to file any registration documents prior to the sale of securities.
The federal government cannot force a sovereign state or local government to jump through federal regulatory hoops just to borrow money.
Right, it's unconstitutional.
So, if there is no SEC prospectus, what does investor Ivan receive? Does he just fly blind?
Not at all. While the SEC cannot force Mayor Mike to file documents, the MSRB can regulate the broker-dealers who sell the bonds.
Ah, the loophole.
Exactly. The MSRB rules state that if an underwriter like Ursula wants to sell these bonds to the public, she must obtain and distribute a document called the Official Statement, or the OS.
The Official Statement is the municipal equivalent of a prospectus.
It is. It is a comprehensive document detailing the purpose of the bond issue, the source of the repayment, the financial demographics of the city, any pending litigation against the city, and the final pricing and interest rates.
It gives Ivan everything he needs to make an informed decision.
But there is a chronological wrinkle here.
Okay, what's the wrinkle?
Before the final pricing was established, Ursula was out there doing road shows and pre-marketing the bonds to gauge interest. She didn't know the final interest rate yet, so what document was she using to pitch the bonds during that phase?
She was using the preliminary official statement, or the POS. Sometimes this is called the red herring, because it used to have red ink stamped on the cover warning that it wasn't final.
That's right.
I think of the POS as a restaurant menu with the dishes beautifully described but a blank space where the prices should be. You know exactly what meal you're getting, the maturity dates, the purpose of the project, but you don't know the exact cost or yield yet.
It lacks the final pricing, interest rates, and offering yields.
That is exactly how it functions. Once the competitive bid is won or the negotiations are finished, the blank spaces are filled in, and the POS becomes the final official statement.
And the MSRB's municipal disclosure rule mandates that underwriters must distribute this final official statement to all purchasers no later than the settlement of the transaction.
However, there is a threshold to be aware of. This rule primarily applies to primary offerings of municipal securities with an aggregate principal amount of $1 million or more.
The $1 million rule.
Why the $1 million cutoff?
It's a pragmatic dividing line between retail protection and institutional efficiency. Offerings under $1 million are generally small, specialized private placements, often bought entirely by a single, sophisticated local bank or a massive institutional investor.
They don't need the hand-holding.
Right. The regulators assume these highly sophisticated entities have the leverage to demand whatever financial information they need directly from the issuer, without the MSRB forcing the creation of a massive, expensive, standardized document.
But once an offering crosses $1 million, it is much more likely to be chopped up into smaller $5,000 pieces and sold to retail investors like Investor Ivan.
And retail investors desperately need the standardized protection of the official statement.
So the official statement is created, but as we established, it is not filed with the SEC. Where does it live permanently? Does it just sit in a dusty filing cabinet in Mayor Mike's basement?
No, it goes to EMA, the Electronic Municipal Market Access System.
EMA. If you are familiar with the corporate stock world, MMA is to municipal bonds what the AGR database is to corporate stocks. It is the centralized public filing cabinet.
Exactly. MMA is an online database operated by the MSRB. And here is a very testable fact. Access to MMA is entirely free to the public.
Free? You don't need a subscription.
Nope. Anyone, including Investor Ivan, can log on to MMA and pull up the official statement for Mayor Mike's bridge bonds. But EMA isn't just a static library for new issues. It is a dynamic platform for continuing disclosure.
Right, because Mayor Mike's bridge bonds might take 30 years to mature. Ivan needs to know if the city is still financially healthy in year 15.
That is why underwriters require issuers to sign a continuing disclosure agreement. Mayor Mike legally agrees that for the life of the bond, he will upload the city's annual audited financial reports to EMA every single year.
This ensures the secondary market has current information to price the bonds accurately.
EMA also handles real-time trade data. If Ivan decides to sell his bond to another investor 5 years from now, that trade information to price and the volume needs to be visible to the market.
Transparency is key.
This is handled by a subsystem called RTRS, the Real-Time Transaction Reporting System.
And here is a specific number you must burn into your memory for the exam. Broker dealers must report secondary market trades to RTRS within exactly 15 minutes of execution.
15 minutes.
Not the end of the day, not within an hour. 15 minutes. It forces transparency into what used to be a very opaque, phone-based market.
Okay, let's test this knowledge with a disaster scenario.
Let's hear it.
Let's imagine 10 years have passed. Mayor Mike's city has suffered a massive economic downturn. Tax revenues have plummeted, and the city has to declare bankruptcy. They are going to default on the bridge bonds.
That is worst case scenario.
This is obviously a massive material event that affects the value of the bonds. How quickly does Mayor Mike have to notify the market by filing a material event notice on EMA? I'll give you a beat to recall the timeline.
Don't get this wrong. He has exactly 10 business days. I want to emphasize business days, not calendar days.
Very important distinction.
The MSRB has a specific list of material events. Bankruptcies, rating downgrades by agencies like Moody's, unscheduled draws on debt service reserves, or missed interest payments. If any of these occur, the issuer must alert the market via AMA within 10 business days.
Excellent. So we have built the bond, we've sold it in the primary market, and we understand the disclosure plumbing that keeps the market transparent.
Now let's step fully into the secondary market. Let's say 5 years have passed. Investor Ivan decides he wants to buy an older existing municipal bond from Broker Bob's inventory. We need to talk about the math and mechanics of secondary trading, starting with how we calculate the days.
Yes, Section 4, Muni Math and Mechanics. If you are calculating the interest owed on a bond, you need to know exactly how many days the investor held it. But the financial calendar is surprisingly weird. For municipal bonds, as well as corporate bonds, the industry uses the 3360-day count convention. This is a relic from the days before computers. When calculating interest across months with 28, 30, or 31 days, using pencil and paper was a nightmare. To simplify the math, the industry universally agreed to pretend that every single month has exactly 30 days, and therefore the year has exactly 360 days.
The exam will try to trip you up by mixing this with the convention used for U.S. government treasury bonds.
Exactly. Treasury bonds use an actual gaseous day count. They count the literal actual days in the calendar month and 365 days in a year.
You must keep these separated in your mind. Munis and corporates equal 3360. Treasuries equal actual actual.
So why is this day counting so critical? It's the foundation for calculating accrued interest.
Explain the mechanics of this, because the cash flow trips a lot of people up. If Ivan buys a bond from Bob and the trade settles exactly halfway between the bond's six-month interest payment dates, who pays who?
At settlement, the buyer, Ivan, must pay the seller, Bob, the accrued interest. The amount is calculated from the last interest payment date up to, but not including, the settlement date of the trade.
Wait, let's walk through the logic of that. Ivan is the one buying the bond. He is paying Bob for the principal value of the bond. Why is he digging deeper into his wallet to give Bob extra cash for interest? Isn't Ivan supposed to receive interest?
He will eventually.
Yeah.
But you have to look at it from Mayor Mike's perspective. The issuer only cuts interest checks twice a year on very specific dates.
Like, say, January 1st and July 1st.
Exactly. Mayor Mike does not care who owned the bond in the middle of those 6 months. He only sends the full six-month check to whoever physically holds the bond on the exact payment date.
Okay.
Now, in our scenario, broker Bob held the bond for the first 90 days of that cycle. Bob's capital was tied up, so Bob rightfully earned 90 days of interest.
Yeah.
But Mayor Mike isn't going to send Bob a partial check.
So Ivan has to make Bob whole.
Exactly. Ivan pays Bob those 90 days of accrued interest out of his own pocket on the day the trade settles. Bob gets his money and walks away happy.
And then what happens to Ivan?
Well, 90 days later, the official payment date arrives. Mayor Mike sends Ivan a check for the full 180 days of interest. That single check pays Ivan back for the 90 days he fronted to Bob, and it pays Ivan the 90 days of interest he actually earned himself while holding the bond.
It is an elegant mechanism to ensure the seller gets paid without burdening the issuer with fractional accounting.
It really is.
Okay, that makes perfect sense. Ivan is essentially fronting the money because the city's accounting department won't do partial payments. Got it. Now, let's move from calculating past interest to predicting future returns. Let's talk about quoting yields, specifically on callable bonds.
Callable bonds are tricky.
A callable bond means Mayor Mike has the right to pay off the bond early, before the maturity date, usually so he can refinance if interest rates drop.
Just like refinancing a mortgage.
Exactly. If Ivan is looking at a callable bond on Bob's screen, Bob has to quote him an estimated yield. But there are two possibilities. Yield to maturity, assuming the bond goes the full distance, or yield to call, assuming the city pays it off early. Which one does Bob legally have to quote?
The overarching MSRB rule is simple, but strict. A dealer must always quote the worst-case scenario for the investor. It is called quoting the yield to worst.
Worst-case scenario.
The logic is that you never want to promise a retail investor a high yield and then deliver a low one because of a call feature. You want to set the most conservative expectation possible.
So the worst-case scenario changes depending on the price Ivan pays for the bond. We have two scenarios to examine, a premium bond and a discount bond. Let's start with a premium.
Let's say Ivan buys a bond at a premium. He pays $1,050 for a bond that has a par value of $1,000. He paid an extra $50. The absolute worst thing that can happen to Ivan is that Mayor Mike calls the bond early at the Borden $1,000 par value.
Wait, why is that bad? Ivan gets $1,000 cash back.
It's bad because Ivan loses his $50 premium much faster than he expected. He thought he had 10 years to earn enough high interest to offset that $50 loss. If the bond is called after 2 years, his return is crushed.
Oh, because he overpaid up front.
Exactly. Plus, bonds are usually called when interest rates have fallen, meaning Ivan now has to reinvest his $1,000 into a market paying much lower rates. This is called reinvestment risk.
That makes sense.
Therefore, for a premium callable bond, the yield to call, or YTC, is mathematically lower than the yield to maturity. YTC is the worst case scenario. Bob must quote the yield to call.
Now let's flip it. What if the bond is trading at a discount? Ivan pays $950 for a $1,000 par value bond.
If Ivan bought it at a discount, an early call is actually a fantastic thing for him. You only pay $950. If Mayor Mike calls the bond early and hands Ivan $1,000, Ivan realizes his $50 capital gain immediately rather than waiting 10 years for it.
Yeah.
It accelerates his profit.
Oh, I see. It's like a fast-forward button on his gains.
Exactly. In this scenario, an early call is the best-case scenario. The worst thing that can happen is that Mayor Mike does not call the bond, and Ivan has to wait the full 10 grueling years to finally get his $1,000 par value.
So for a discount callable bond, the yield to maturity, or YTM, is the lowest worst-case yield. Bob must quote the yield to maturity. Let me summarize that, because it is vital for the exam. Premium bond, the call hurts you. Quote, yield to call. Discount bond, the call helps you. Quote, yield to maturity. You always quote whatever mathematically results in the lowest number for the investor.
Yield to worst. Always.
Okay, now we arrive at the absolute holy grail of Series 7 math. If you take away only one formula from this entire episode, make it this one. The taxable equivalent yield, or TEY.
You will see this formula on your exam. It is practically guaranteed. The TEY calculation is the entire basis for why the municipal bond market exists in the first place.
The formula is tax-exempt yield divided by parenthesis 1 minus the marginal tax rate, close parenthesis. So TEY equals muni yield divided by 1 minus tax rate. Let's unpack the economic reality behind this. Why are we dividing by 1 minus the tax rate?
Think about it from investor Ivan's perspective. Ivan is sitting at his desk trying to make an investment decision. He is looking at Mayor Mike's tax-free municipal bond yielding 4%.
Okay, 4% tax-free.
But right next to it, he sees a taxable corporate bond from Apple yielding 5.5%. He wants to know which one puts more actual cash in his pocket at the end of the year.
Right, because the Apple bond gets taxed.
Yes. To compare apples to apples, Ivan needs to calculate exactly how much the taxable corporate bond has to earn before the IRS takes their cut in order to leave him with the exact same amount as the tax-free muni.
So the denominator of the formula, 1 minus the tax rate, represents the portion of the taxable interest Ivan actually gets to keep.
Precisely. If Ivan is in the 30% tax bracket, the government takes 30 cents of every dollar of corporate interest. That means Ivan keeps 70 cents, or 0.70. You divide the muni yield by the percentage the investor gets to keep.
Okay, let's do a direct question for the listener to lock this in. Let's walk through the math. Let's say investor Ivan is in a high tax bracket. He pays 32% to the IRS. He sees Mayor Mike's municipal bond yielding exactly 4% tax-free. What does a fully taxable corporate bond need to yield to exactly match that 4% after taxes? I'll give you a beat to run the steps in your head. Start with the denominator.
Calculate what he keeps.
Okay, step one. The tax rate is 32%, so 1 minus 0.32 is 0.68. Ivan keeps 68% of his taxable income. Step two, you take the muni yield, 4%, and divide it by 0.68. The answer is 5.88%.
That 5.88% is the taxable equivalent yield. It means a corporate bond yielding 5.88% will give Ivan the exact same after-tax spending money as the 4% municipal bond.
Now, Ivan can make a smart decision. If he looks at the market and sees Apple corporate bonds are only paying 5%, he should immediately buy the 4% muni because the muni provides a higher after-tax return.
Right. 4 is better than 5 if 5 gets taxed down to like 3.4.
But if he finds a corporate bond yielding 6.5%, he should buy the corporate bond, pay the taxes, and he'll still come out ahead.
And here's a critical exam trap. Sometimes the test will try to trick you by offering an answer choice where they multiplied the yield by the tax rate instead of dividing.
Oh, that's me.
Never multiply. The taxable equivalent yield must always be a higher number than the muni yield because you are calculating a gross pre-tax number. Always divide by 1 minus the tax rate.
Moving right along, let's step back and look at the macro picture. How did underwriter Ursula know what interest rate to put on Mayor Mike's bonds in the primary market in the first place? She doesn't just pull a number out of thin air.
No, she doesn't.
She looks at the broader market indicators to gauge the current cost of borrowing.
She relies heavily on The Bond Buyer, which is the definitive daily publication tracking the municipal market.
Like the Wall Street Journal for munis?
Pretty much. The Bond Buyer publishes three main indexes that track the yields of new issue municipal bonds. These indexes act like the Dow Jones or the S&P 500, but specifically for local government debt.
The three major ones are the BB20, the BB11, and the BB40. Let's break them down.
The BB20, also known as the 20 Bond Index, is an index tracking the average yield of 20 general obligation bonds. The key criteria is that these 20 bonds must be rated A or better. It represents a broad cross-section of good, solid municipal debt.
Okay, the BB20 is solid A-rated Jerry bonds.
Then you have the BB11, or the 11 Bond Index. This is a subset of the BB20. It tracks 11 general obligation bonds, but these must be rated AA or better.
Higher rating.
Finally, the BB40 tracks the yields of 40 revenue bonds.
Wait, hold on. I want to look closely at the relationship between the BB20 and the BB11. The BB11 index is tracking a smaller pool of bonds, only 11 compared to 20. But the textbook says the yield on the BB11 is generally lower than the yield on the BB20.
That's right.
If I am lending money, a smaller pool of assets usually implies less diversification, which should mean more risk. Why am I getting paid a lower yield for what looks like a smaller sample size?
It is a totally logical question, and it is exactly why the exam tests it. But what is fascinating here is that the yield difference has absolutely nothing to do with the quantity of bonds in the index. It is entirely driven by the quality of the bond.
That honor roll concept.
Exactly. Think of the BB20 as the entire junior class at a high school. They're all decent students, A or above. But the BB11 is the National Honor Society.
Ah, the smart kids.
It takes only the absolute best, highest quality AA-rated bonds from that larger group. In finance, there's an ironclad, unbreakable rule.
Right.
Higher credit quality equals lower risk.
Right.
And lower risk means investors are willing to accept a lower yield in exchange for safety. Because the BB11 is composed exclusively of top-tier, ultra-safe AA bonds, its average yield is naturally going to be lower than the broader BB20, which includes slightly riskier single A bonds.
Higher credit quality equals lower yield. That makes perfect sense. Now, besides tracking yields, Ursula is also looking at two other metrics published by the bond buyer to gauge the momentum of the market, the visible supply and the placement ratio. I like to think of these as driving a car.
Explain the car analogy.
Visible supply is looking out the windshield. It measures the total dollar amount of new municipal bond issues scheduled to hit the market in the next 30 days. It is literally what is coming at us on the road ahead.
Good visual.
The placement ratio, on the other hand, is looking in the rearview mirror. It measures what percentage of last week's new bond issues were actually sold to investors versus what was left sitting on the underwriter's shelves. It's the traffic we just passed.
That is a perfect visualization. And the exam will test you on how these two indicators impact future interest rates. Let's play it out.
Okay.
Ursula looks out the windshield and sees a massive visible supply. There are billions and billions of dollars of new municipal bonds scheduled to come to market next week from cities all over the country. What does that impending flood of supply do to yields?
Well, it's basic supply and demand. If the market is about to be flooded with new bonds, issuers like Mayor Mike are going to have to compete fiercely to attract investor Ivan's dollars.
Exactly.
If Ivan has 100 different bonds to choose from, he is going to demand a higher return. To attract buyers, Mayor Mike will have to offer higher interest rates. So a high visible supply puts upward pressure on yields.
Correct. Yeah. And conversely, let's look at the rearview mirror. If the placement ratio for last week was very high, say 95%, that means demand is incredibly strong. Investors devoured almost everything the underwriters brought to the market.
That signals a robust, healthy market environment.
When underwriters see that ravenous demand, they know they don't have to offer incredibly high interest rates to sell their upcoming bonds. Strong demand allows them to lower the rates they offer. So a high placement ratio generally stabilizes or even lowers yields.
Okay, we've priced the bond. Ivan bought it. He's happily earning his interest. Now we enter the most perilous territory of municipal finance. What happens when the IRS comes knocking on investor Ivan's door? We need to talk about taxes.
The foundational premise of this entire asset class is that the interest paid on municipal bonds is generally exempt from federal income tax. But what about state taxes? This is where location matters immensely.
Let's use Ivan. If Ivan lives in New York City and he buys Mayor Mike's New York State Bridge bond, the interest he earns is completely tax-free at the federal level, the state level, and the local city level. He pays nothing. It is a triple tax-free bond.
A great deal for Ivan.
Yeah.
But if Ivan lives in New York and his broker, Bob, sells him a municipal bond issued by the state of California, Ivan still avoids federal taxes because the federal government doesn't tax any state's debt.
Okay.
However, New York State is going to tax that California interest. States are highly competitive. New York has absolutely no incentive to give Ivan a tax break for funding a bridge in California. They only offer state tax exemptions for in-state bonds.
Except for one major, highly testable exception. There is a trap here regarding U.S. territories.
Yes. Bonds issued by U.S. territories, specifically Puerto Rico, Guam, and the U.S. Virgin Islands, enjoy a unique statutory exemption.
The ultimate loophole.
They are triple tax-free for everyone, regardless of what state the investor lives in. If Ivan in New York buys a Puerto Rico utility bond, It is federally, state, and locally tax-free. The exam loves testing Puerto Rico bonds because they break the standard state tax rule.
Now, here is a reality check that blows people's minds and causes massive headaches at tax time. We have established that municipal bond interest payments are tax exempt. But what if Ivan buys Mayor Mike's bond in the secondary market for $900, holds it for a year, and then sells it to another investor for $950?
Ivan just made a $50 capital gain. And the IRS is ruthless about this. Capital gains on municipal bonds are absolutely 100% taxable.
Only the regular scheduled interest payments are exempt.
A municipal bond is still an asset. If you buy the asset low and sell it high, you owe capital gains tax on the profit, period. There's no exemption for trading profits.
Okay, now we need to wade into the deepest, most complex waters of muni math. How the IRS handles premiums versus discounts in the secondary market. Let's tackle premiums first.
Brace yourself.
Ivan buys a bond in the secondary market. The bond has a par value of $1,000, but because interest rates have fallen and the bond is highly desirable, Ivan has to pay $1,050 for it. It matures in exactly 5 years.
Yeah.
At maturity, Mayor Mike is only going to hand Ivan $1,000. Ivan is mathematically guaranteed to lose $50 of principal over those 5 years.
The IRS does not allow Ivan to just take a sudden $50 capital loss at the end of year five. They require him to amortize that premium over the remaining life of the bond.
Amortize? What does that mean, practically?
Amortization is a fancy accounting word for spreading the loss out evenly. If he loses $50 over 5 years, that is $10 a year. Every single year, Ivan must reduce his official cost basis in the bond by $10.
Let's track his basis. He buys it at $1,050. After year one, he writes it down to $1,040. After year two, $1,030. He keeps stepping it down until right at maturity, his basis is exactly $1,000.
So when the city pays him his $1,000 par value, his basis matches the payout, meaning he has exactly zero capital loss to claim on his taxes.
And here is the brutal exam prep regarding that $10 annual step down. In the corporate bond world, you can sometimes deduct that amortization against your income. But for municipal bonds, can Ivan deduct that $10 annual premium amortization as a loss on his tax return?
The answer is an absolute no.
Why not?
You have to think like the IRS. The IRS says, look, Ivan, you paid an extra $50 premium simply because this bond pays a ridiculously high tax-free interest rate. We are already letting you receive that high interest rate completely tax-free. You do not get to double dip. You cannot claim a tax deduction on the premium you paid to acquire tax-free income.
They close the loophole.
Therefore, premium amortization on a municipal bond must be calculated to adjust the basis, but the amortized amount is strictly not deductible.
Excellent breakdown. Now let's look at the other side of the coin. Discounts. This is the ultimate showdown on the Series 7. OID versus market discount. OID stands for original issue discount. This dictates whether a discount is a tax-free gift or a taxable nightmare.
It really is a showdown.
I think the best way to understand this is to use a real estate metaphor. Let's compare buying a house with a missing roof to buying a perfect house in a neighborhood that suddenly crashes. Let's start with OID, original issue discount.
OID occurs when the municipality itself deliberately creates the discount on day one. Mayor Mike needs to issue a zero coupon bond. It pays no regular interest. So, to entice investors, he issues the $1,000 bond at a price of $900.
This is the house with the missing roof. The builder, Mayor Mike, knows the house isn't finished, it doesn't pay interest, so he sells it to you brand new for $900 instead of $1,000. The discount was baked into the original creation of the asset.
Because the issuer created the discount as a substitute for regular interest payments, the IRS treats the gradual growth, the accretion from $900 up to the $1,000 par value over the life of the bond as part of the bond's original intended interest package.
And since the interest on a municipal bond is tax exempt, that OID accretion is entirely tax exempt.
Yes. If Ivan buys an OID bond and holds it to maturity, the $100 gain he realizes is treated as tax-free interest.
But market discount is a completely different animal. This is the perfect house in the crashed neighborhood.
Okay, tell me about the crashed neighborhood.
Let's say Mayor Mike issues a perfectly normal 5% interest bond at a full price of $1,000. It's a finished house. But over the next few years, national interest rates skyrocket to 8%.
Rates go up, bond prices go down.
Suddenly, nobody wants Mayor Mike's 5% bond. The value of the bond plummets in the secondary market. Years later, Ivan buys this bond from another investor for $900.
Notice the difference. Mayor Mike didn't give Ivan a discount. The city still thinks it's a $1,000 bond.
Right.
The secondary market gave Ivan the discount because the asset lost value due to external interest rate changes.
Mm-hmm.
The asset didn't change. The market's valuation of it did.
So what does the IRS say about this?
The IRS says, Ivan, you just bought a distressed asset on the cheap. The $100 profit you're going to make when the city pays you $1,000 at maturity was not designed by the city as tax-free interest. It is simply a speculative profit you made by buying a devalued asset in the secondary market.
Huh.
Therefore, the IRS rules that market discount accretion is not tax-exempt. When the bond matures, that $100 gain is treated as a taxable capital gain, and specifically, it is taxed at your higher ordinary income rate.
The missing roof is tax-free. The crash neighborhood is taxable. OID accretion is tax-exempt. Market discount accretion is taxable ordinary income. That is one of the most vital distinctions to make.
You must ask, who created the discount? The issuer on day one or the secondary market years later? The answer dictates the entire tax treatment.
Let's stick with taxes for one more minute and address a specific trap that catches high net worth investors, the AMT or alternative minimum tax. Who does this affect and how does it relate to municipal bonds?
The AMT was designed decades ago to ensure that extremely wealthy individuals couldn't use loopholes and massive deductions to bring their tax bill down to zero.
So it's basically a parallel tax system.
Essentially, yes.
Yeah.
The IRS calculates a high earner's taxes normally and then calculates them a second time using the strict AMT rules, which throw out many deductions. The taxpayer is forced to pay whichever number is higher.
And the catch for municipal bonds revolves around a specific type of debt called private activity bonds.
Let's say Mayor Mike issues a bond not to build a public school, but to build a new stadium for a private professional sports franchise or a new terminal for a private airline.
So the city issues the debt, but a private corporation heavily benefits from it.
This is a private activity bond. Under normal circumstances, the interest on this bond is still tax exempt. But if investor Ivan is a high earner subject to the alternative minimum tax, the IRS changes the rules.
Uh-oh.
For AMT taxpayers, the interest from private activity bonds gets added back into their taxable income as a tax preference item.
Exactly. Suddenly, Ivan's tax-free bond is generating fully taxable income. This creates a massive suitability issue for brokers.
A huge issue.
If Ivan explicitly tells broker Bob that he is subject to the AMT, Bob must strictly avoid recommending any private activity bonds. He must ensure Ivan only buys standard general obligation bonds or revenue bonds for essential public services like water and sewer, which are completely immune to the AMT.
Speaking of suitability, I have a direct question for you, the listener. Let's think about investor Ivan's nephew, Timmy.
Okay, Timmy.
Timmy is 19 years old. He just got his first part-time job working at a coffee shop. She makes maybe $15,000 a year. He is in the absolute lowest possible tax bracket. In fact, he probably pays no federal income tax at all.
Zero.
Timmy managed to save $2,000 and wants to invest it safely. Should broker Bob recommend a tax-free municipal bond to Timmy? Give it a bead. And think about the math we've discussed.
The answer is an absolute unequivocal NO. Why? Because Timmy doesn't pay enough taxes for the exemption to matter.
It's waste.
Remember the trade-off. Municipal bonds pay significantly lower interest rates than corporate bonds because of the tax benefit. If Timmy buys a muni yielding 4%, he gets 4%. If he buys a taxable corporate bond yielding 6%, he might pay zero taxes on it anyway because his income is so low, so he gets to keep the full 6%.
Exactly. If Bob sells Timmy a muni, Timmy is essentially paying for a tax exemption he fundamentally does not need.
It is a critical violation of suitability rules. You must match the product to the investor's tax bracket. Municipal bonds are explicitly designed for high bracket investors who need to shelter their income. Recommending them to a low income investor is a textbook exam failure.
All right, we have navigated the primary market, the disclosures, the secondary market math, and the IRS minefield.
We're almost to the finish line.
We are moving into our final logistical section. Wrapping up the trade. When Ivan calls Bob and agrees to buy a municipal bond from Bob's inventory, when does the actual exchange of cash for securities happen? When does the trade settle?
For standard secondary market trades of municipal bonds, regular way settlement is T plus one, trade date plus one, business day.
T plus one.
If Ivan agrees to the trade on Monday, the cash and the bonds must officially change hands by Tuesday. This is the exact same settlement cycle used for corporate stocks and corporate bonds.
But what if Ivan is buying a brand new bond in the primary market? Let's say he placed a presale order with Ursula's Syndicate for Mayor Mike's bridge bonds. The syndicate won the bid, but the physical bonds haven't even been finalized or printed by the city yet. How can Ivan settle a trade for something that doesn't exist?
That is called a when-issued trade. Ivan and Ursula agree on the price and the yield, but there is no set settlement date at the time of the trade. They are trading the promise of a bond.
The confirmation Ivan receives will say DII for when issued. The final settlement date won't be determined until the physical securities are finally delivered by the city to the lead underwriter, which could take weeks.
And one final grim scenario to cover. What happens if Mayor Mike's city goes totally bankrupt?
It happens.
We discussed the MA reporting, but what happens to the bond itself in the secondary market? If Ivan decides to sell his bankrupt bridge bond to a distressed debt hedge fund, how does accrued interest work?
If a bond is in default, or if the issuer has missed an interest payment, the bond trades flat.
Trading for
Trading flat means it trades without any accrued interest. In our earlier example, Ivan paid Bob 90 days of interest because he expected Mayor Mike to reimburse him. But if the city is bankrupt, neither the buyer nor the seller is expecting an interest check anytime soon.
So the buyer simply pays the distressed market value of the principal and not a penny more for accrued interest. The bond is flat, dead in the water.
Okay, take a deep breath. We have covered a massive amount of ground today, from the initial notice of sale to the final bankruptcy flat trade.
To make sure this locks into your brain for exam day, we are going to do a rapid-fire recap of the absolute most testable takeaways from this entire episode.
Number one, MSRB rules require pre-use principal approval for all municipal advertisements. It must be approved before first use to protect retail trust, never after. And social media posts count as advertisements.
Number two, in underwriting syndicates, Eastern accounts mean shared, undivided liability, the restaurant bill where you pay for everyone's mistakes. Western accounts mean individual, divided liability. Eastern accounts carry significantly higher risk for the individual firm.
Number three, in the underwriting spread, the selling concession is always the largest piece because distributing to retail is the hardest job. And crucially, the total takedown formula strictly excludes the management fee.
Number four. The MSRB's EMA system is the free, centralized public database for official statements and continuing disclosures. And secondary market trades must be reported to the RTRS system within exactly 15 minutes of execution.
Number five, the tax rules. Premium amortization on a municipal bond is never tax deductible. OID accretion, the discount created by the issuer, is tax-free. Market discount accretion, the discount created by secondary market forces, is fully taxable as ordinary income.
And number six, U.S. territory bonds, like those from Puerto Rico or Guam, are a unique exception. They are triple tax-free for everyone, no matter what U.S. state you live in.
As we wrap up this deep dive, I want to leave you with a broader thought to connect all this dense regulatory plumbing to the real world.
Yeah, let's zoom out.
We spent an hour talking about MSRB enforcement, tax exemptions, syndicate structures, and yield calculations. When you are staring at a textbook, it can feel like archaic Wall Street trivia.
Totally.
But consider the macro reality, the entire physical infrastructure of the United States. Every local bridge Mayor Mike builds, every public school, every municipal water treatment plant, every local hospital relies almost entirely on this highly specific financial plumbing and the federal tax exemption that keeps borrowing costs low.
Right. Mayor Mike literally couldn't afford to build that toll bridge if he had to pay the same interest rates as a massive tech corporation. The tax exemption is a federal subsidy for local development.
Exactly. And every few years, politicians in Washington debate repealing the municipal tax exemption in an attempt to close the federal deficit. It's a massive pool of untaxed wealth.
But think about the cascading consequences.
Right. If Congress ever fully repealed that exemption, municipal bonds would suddenly have to offer the exact same high yields as corporate bonds just to attract buyers like Ivan.
Which means Mayor Mike has to pay more.
How would local cash-strapped governments survive that sudden massive explosion in their borrowing costs? The municipal bond market would fundamentally freeze, or local property and sales taxes would have to skyrocket to cover the new exorbitant interest payments.
That's intense.
Think about that delicate economic balance as you take your exam. The rules you are studying aren't just red tape designed to make the Series 7 difficult. They are the literal financial bedrock that allows every city in the country to function and grow.
That is a staggering thought to end on. The entire skyline of American cities rests on the foundation of that one tax rule we dissected today.
All right, you have put in the hard work. You have gone incredibly deep into the mechanics, the math, and the regulations. Keep reviewing the total takedown and taxable equivalent yield formulas. Remember the characters we follow today, and go crush this section of the exam. You got this. Until next time.